First, we're going to be thinking about the politics of class through the medium of country music. The Old Mole's Bill Resnick has been talking with Dean Hubbs, a professor of music and women's studies, about some common misunderstandings of working class culture, the notions that the people who are sometimes called hillbillies or rednecks are homophobic and rabid supporters of Donald Trump. Their music tells a different story. During the first part of this interview, we will hear some country songs that illustrate the discussion, and in the second part of the interview, Dean Hubbs will talk specifically about the songs we have heard in part one.
I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly.
Dean Hubbs, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill.
Dean Hubbs is professor of women's studies and music at the University of Michigan. She directs the Lesbian, Gay, Queer Research Initiative in Michigan's Institute for Research in Women and Gender. Her work is focused on popular and classical music of the 20th century to the present, including Aaron Copland and Virgil Thompson, 1970s disco, Radiohead, and other well-known groups, and also post-war country, including Dolly Parton, Gretchen Wilson, David Allan Coe. Her major writing is the book Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. That book is an important addition to a growing body of work that challenges the conventional images of working people, and especially the people called rednecks, and those images that define them as ignorant, racist, sexist, homophobic, and thoroughly inferior to the much more sensitive and thoughtful middle class. Dean Hubbs is also a musician, plays with, among others, the Pittsfield Ramblers. Dean Hubbs, tell us your life course, how you wound up writing rednecks, queers, and country music.
Well, I wound up writing rednecks, queers, and country music as my second book. The first book was on some of the people you mentioned, Aaron Copland, Virgil Thompson, Leonard Bernstein, Paul Bowles, and it was called The Queer Composition of America's Sound. This one, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, I couldn't write until I was older. It was just so hard. And even then, even after I had tenure at the University of Michigan and had written two other large manuscripts, it was really, really hard to write. It has the most to do with my earlier life. I was born in Toledo, Ohio, which is now the Rust Belt, when there was still a lot of manufacturing going on, and my dad worked on the railroad. And eventually was an engineer and drove freight trains full of things like steel from Pittsburgh and Youngstown and Cleveland, glass and windshields from Toledo, which was the glass capital of the world. A lot of it was headed up to Detroit to be made into cars.
Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City, and I dreamed about those cotton fields and home. I dreamed about my mother, dear old papa, sister, and brother. I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home. I wanna go home.
Up in a working class world, but when the working class was in a very different situation. My dad worked a working class job, but was able to have for his family a middle class standard of living. And I grew up in a small town outside Toledo, out in the cornfields, and loved music. But I should say, I had those great CKLW waves hitting my little transistor radio. CKLW was the amazing AM radio voice of Motown in the 70s. So I was listening to tons of Motown. I was listening to lots of rock. And my parents and my aunts and uncles were listening to country music. So I had an education in country of what I might call the golden age through my aunt and uncle's jukebox in their little small town beer joint. My cousins and I really identified away from country music.
We're from North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
So that was another thing about this project. I had to come back around after lots of elite education and years of feeling the need to try to pass as middle class, and now as a tenured professor in an elite university where I'm mostly in contact with upper middle class privileged people. I had to find some way to come back to country music and try to write this book. I actually had to move out of Ann Arbor. I always call it an NPR town. I moved to a village 10 miles outside town so that I could have a neighbor with a bitchin' Camaro and get to a place where my mind could actually form a thought about the American working class.
And you began becoming sensitive to the constant disparagement of particularly rednecks as a symbol somehow of working class ignorance and disparagement of their music and of their lives, especially in comparison to the privileged and educated.
That was something that I couldn't help but be aware of throughout my life. And it was certainly clear to me when I was in graduate school at the University of Michigan in a music school that was focused on classical music, in a time when classical music still had some cultural purchase. And I still had professors who would have shamed you for admitting that you listened to popular music at all. So country music was really just off the table. So when I use rednecks in the title of my book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, the term is best understood from two angles. One is the angle where people would actually call themselves rednecks. And that term had always been a pejorative term, but it did undergo a reclamation in the early 70s. And you remember Billy Carter, when Jimmy Carter ran for president, started to be called the first redneck, the president's brother. There was a kind of a redneck moment in the early 70s, and there were a rash of country songs about the redneck, and that was the time when people actually began to claim the term for themselves, kind of a redneck pride movement, in the same way that the word queer had been pejorative and then was reclaimed somewhere around the late 80s, early 90s. So I was acutely aware in elite spaces and in middle-class spaces of how that sort of redneck was more than unfashionable. And then the other meaning of redneck that I mean to invoke in the title is the one where people who wouldn't call themselves rednecks but are white working class folk get called rednecks by others who stand above them and judge them and use it indeed as a pejorative in a sloppy way to refer to anyone who looks to them white and working class and just must hold all the opinions and tastes that are presumed to belong to that group.
Let's get your very interesting story with students. You ask them what kind of music do they like. Tell us that story.
I love my students at University of Michigan. A lot of them are privileged. Not all of them are. When it comes to their musical taste, I think they're pretty representative of their generation. I found the same thing when I traveled through the South talking about country music as I was writing this book. Even in the Deep South, particularly I remember at University of Alabama down in Tuscaloosa, I had undergraduate students tell me this phrase, anything but country, is the answer to the question, what do you listen to? It's the standard answer among their peers. It's a phrase that's used by people in their 30s and 40s as well. Research shows that when people use that phrase I'll listen to anything but country. They're not only making a declaration of taste, but they're also distancing themselves from the audience who are most associated with country music. And one study found that the audience was thought of as least educated members of society.
And ignorant, sort of brutish, racist. And now, when you say redneck, they're seen as homophobic. This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Dean Hubbs, who wrote a book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, which is part of a growing but still slim genre that challenges the mythology of working class deficiency in all things. Dean Hubbs, it seems to me that it's embedded in the language and in conventional wisdom and in people's expectations, those deficiency portraits. So they're always defining themselves up against this sort of ignorant working class that they don't want to be seen as. It's an attack on working people's ideas and feelings and political positions. We see it everywhere, in fact. Why don't you discuss the functions of that definition of the other?
I'm a great admirer of the work of Bev Skaggs, a sociologist in London, and probably of working class origins, has done a lot of brilliant work. And she, at times, goes into the history of the classes. And England, of course, is a better place to see the origin story even than it is here. If we look at the origins of the middle class and the working class in the Industrial Revolution, we see that there can be no middle class unless there's a working class to define themselves against. So even if this society got serious about trying to do away with classism, and we had public service ads and teaching school kids about classism and all the things we would do to try to get serious about that, which of course we haven't begun to do, nevertheless, structurally, it's built into the very definition. In order to be a middle-class individual, the first thing you have to accomplish is to not be working class, to not be specifically a member of the working class masses. So a defining difference between middle class and working class status is, in the middle class, you are an individual, you're a distinguished individual, and you distinguish yourself precisely from the undifferentiated masses who are relegated to the working class. So if you see that as the very design, the definition of the two classes and of class difference, I think that goes far toward answering your question about these continuous attacks. The terms may change, but essentially we would have to change something much deeper in order to make any meaningful change. And now let me get to the other part of your question, which is about the history of the last 40 years. You recapped my argument, which is about homophobia and the homophobia that is now attributed to the working class. Well, we're very familiar with this. In fact, I think for a lot of people, when you think of a vicious homophobe nowadays, the image would be a working class person and quite possibly a white working class person and quite possibly a non-urban, rural, white working class person, and maybe, to sum it all up in one word, a redneck of some sort. Those were the folks who were blamed for Matthew Shepard's murder, at least in the most popular version, redneck homophobes. They are the folks who are the murderers of a beautiful young trans man in the film Boys Don't Cry. You see them once again murderous and vicious in fictional Brokeback Mountain. That is our image. In fact, we have a tremendous historical amnesia that allows us to forget that it was only 40 years ago when the sin of the working class was not that they were queer haters, but that they were queer lovers. And that was their position and the status they occupied in society for about 100 years, from around 1870, which is when LGBT historians place the quote-unquote birth of the homosexual, the invention of the homosexual by psychiatry and medicine, and then its uptake by institutions like the law and the media. Well, that was a middle-class process. That was top-down. That was science. In the working class, there had been folk versions of sexuality and of queerness on the ground, of course, before that. It's not like we invented same-sex activity by inventing the homosexual around 1870 among sexologists and medical experts. So for about 100 years, respectability, which is the defining attribute of the middle class, respectability required that you distance yourself from queer activity, queer people. In that period, waterfront docks, working class neighborhoods like Harlem, and working class folk were associated, and not incorrectly, with queer activity, homosexual activity.
When you say not incorrectly, we're not talking about these polar definitions. It was that sexuality was far more fluid in the working class. And in some cases, men who were primarily sort of heterosexual, but they would still have sometimes or many times or be bisexual. That is that sexuality wasn't defined as somehow in terms of masculinity and femininity, at least wasn't practiced, not defined as being either male or female or same-sex or hetero. But there was a lot more love between people of the same sex, and that was accepted and tolerated and seen as okay.
There was more fluidity, yes. Gender figured in a complex way, but definitely, and to bring up a current example, in the African-American working class, and now the rest of the society is aware of it too, the past 15, 20 years, the phrase on the down low illustrates that sort of fluidity. It didn't mean that you belong to a separate species of human as the hetero-homo divide would insist. And for a long time, that concept did not have the same impact in the working class. So as you say, there was more fluidity. That concept whereby a homosexual person is really a separate kind of human from a heterosexual person, it wasn't present in folk systems of gender and sexuality, and it was kind of ignored and not really a part of life in working class worlds for a long time. And so as for the actual systems, the sex gender systems, the LGBT historian George Chauncey have written about the history of a system of male sexuality in which you had people who were called sometimes rough trade and other people who were called fairies or pansies. And in fact, it was based on gender more than sexuality. In that system, if you were rough trade, and you might be a soldier or a sailor or a cop in uniform, you could have sex with a male or a female partner, and it did not determine whether you were quote-unquote normal or queer, because the divisions hinged upon whether you took the so-called manly role or the so-called womanly role in sex. So there is more fluidity in that sense, whereas at the same time in the middle-class world, you would have been called homosexual regardless of your gender style, regardless of whether you presented yourself in masculine or feminine ways, and regardless of what sexual position you took.
Trailers for sale or rent, rooms to let 50 cents, no phone, no pool, no pets, ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys an 8-12 four-bedroom. I'm a man of means, by no means king of the road.
So they were completely different systems, but as you can see, it did allow more fluidity, and it allowed for more people to be, quote-unquote, normal, and there was a way in which it allowed more freedom. And in working-class worlds, a man could proposition another man, and the other man was more likely to be receptive, regardless of whether he was married or had a family or didn't. And in any case, if he wasn't interested, it wasn't as big a deal. Like, no thanks.
On the other hand, it's radically changed now. Now that homosexuality is now acceptable, the upper middle class now, in their efforts to distinguish themselves from working class people. Now the image of the working class has become, they are the homophobes.
Absolutely.
But it's really just a change in this conventional wisdom developed, written about, and uttered by professional classes. They're the ones who have constructed these ideas as a, really when you see the function of them, as a way of maintaining their right to rule, their superiority, their class privileges, and it's unconscious to them.
That's right. And so what I do in Rednex Cruise and Country Music is I notice, first of all, that there's this 180 turn. Wait a minute. I thought that the problem was that the working class are a bunch of unprincipled, immoral, degenerate, and primitive queer lovers. The story used to be, are so inferior that they can't even distinguish the right and appropriate partner with whom to have sex. So that was, for generations, the sin of the working class. And how could it totally flip around to a 180 so that now the problem is the working class are so degenerate and so inferior and primitive that they are hateful, slobbering homophobes without anyone taking note? Well, I noticed it, and partly that was because of my life experience, because when I was a kid growing up and I was contemplating this journey, I couldn't really picture it in any detail, but I was contemplating going to college and so having a trajectory of moving into the middle class. At least I was going to try. And one of the really scary things to me, because as a kid I was out pretty young to myself back in that day, coming out didn't mean coming out to the world and coming out to straight people. The scary thing to me was coming out to these middle-class people.
Dean Hobbs, one final thing. This attack on working people as the source of all evil, it continues in so many forms, and one of them is the sort of the understanding that's been promoted about the Trump phenomena and who votes for Trump. And it's a continuation, of course, of that same discourse, who voted for Hitler, who voted for Wallace. These privileged classes think this is an ignorant and biased and bigoted expression from working class people who don't even see their own interests somehow.
Yeah, first of all, I couldn't agree with you more about this being a continuation. My favorite whipping boy, I speak in the book about Tom Frank's 2004 blockbuster bestseller, which was, again, telling the same story, who voted for Hitler. The title of the book was What's the Matter with Kansas? And this book was so fervently embraced. It's telling the story, again, of false consciousness, of a working class who's too dumb to recognize their own interests, and they're motivated by so-called social interests, supposedly, to vote against their very own interests and vote in the Republicans who hurt them the most. In fact, political science research does not support this. And generally, poor folks still vote for Democrats and rich folks still vote for Republicans. The greatest exception to that from the political science literature I've read is not where poor folks vote for Republicans, but rather for where rich folks, rich liberals, do vote for Democrats. The story is very old and it's coming up again with Trump. Once again, we really ought to examine the bases of the story. It's full of distortion. It's inaccurate. But we've got what I call in the book the narrating class. And the narrating class are a portion of the professional middle class who tell the stories. And they tell the stories not just for the folks they know, the middle class. They tell the stories for everyone. And not only do they not know the working class, they're getting further and further away.
You might think I'm trashy, a little too hardcore, but in my neck of the woods, I'm just a girl next door. Hey, I'm a redneck woman, I ain't no high-class broad. I'm just a product of my reins, and I say, hey, y'all, Andy Hall. And I keep my Christmas lights on my front porch all year long. And I know all the words to every Tanya Tucker song. So here's to all my sisters out there keeping it clean.
Dean Hubbs, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure, Bill.
It was
thanks
great.
For having me.
Thank you.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland. I'm your host, Clayton Morgridge. We've just heard part one of Bill Resnick's discussion with Dean Hubbs, professor of music and women's studies at the University of Michigan, about some misconceptions about country music and country people. Now, here's a short follow-up discussion between Bill and Dean, in which Dean talks about each of the songs we heard in the first part.
Hi, folks. You just heard me, Bill Resnick, and Nadine Hubbs, who teaches at the University of Michigan and wrote the book Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. We discussed how the moneyed and educated and their intellectuals and pundits describe working people in negative terms, that they're less tolerant and understanding, more rigid, oppressive, small-minded. Whether it's homophobia or voting for Trump, it's those damn rednecks and working people who are causing us the problems. In fact, as you heard, that's not the case. As to homophobia, it was an invention of elites, doctors, psychiatrists, academics, who declared same-sex relations as unnatural, bestial, against the Bible, destroying the family. It was working people, in fact, through those years who lived and let lived, and in fact, were far more accepting of homoerotic relations. After the interview, Dean Hubbs and I, we decided we had to play some country music that also illustrated this. She chose a bunch of country music songs to play. You just heard them during the interview, excerpts of them. Dean Hubbs is now on the line. Dean, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So, Dean, remind me of your story, how you came to appreciate and study country music, and tell us about those songs that we played excerpts from.
Well, I grew up hearing some of those songs, sort of golden era songs that we heard. We started at 1963 with Bobby Bear in Detroit City, and I grew up within always 50 miles or so of Detroit, having been born in Toledo. And since my aunt and uncle owned a little beer joint in a tiny little farm town outside Toledo, they had great classic songs at the time. They weren't yet classics on that jukebox, and I had grown up with that music. By the time I left the working class world of my childhood and went away to college and then found my way into graduate school, always studying classical music, I had gone a great distance away from country music. It was just understood. That was an unacceptable pace. So I found my way back only after I had tenure at the University of Michigan, after I had published my first book, which was about gay composers in American classical music. And I found my way back and started studying country music because I wanted, at that point, finally to write what would be the most difficult book I could contemplate, which was a book about the American working class. It's a very hard cause to take up, as I think you know.
And you began re-examining a lot of the old songs and then re-appreciating country music in this process. Why don't you tell us about the songs that we heard?
Well, that first one was Bobby Bear's Detroit City. I hear that as a song about northern migration. African-American folks came up from the Deep South. White folks came up from the Mid-South mostly. Around here, I grew up around so many kids who were the product of that sort of northern migration. We speak around Detroit of the Hillbilly Highway, the routes that folks took, the white folks who sometimes self-identified as hillbillies from Kentucky and Tennessee and around there in the Mid-South, and the loneliness. Folks came up, the black and white people came up to find jobs in the factories when America was still doing a lot of manufacturing in cities like Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland, Akron, Chicago, Baltimore, etc. And they would make good money in the post-war prosperity years, often in a union job. But he was talking about having gone from a rural life to a city life, that folks down home thought was quite glamorous, but was in fact lonely. So that was a really big song in 1963. It was number 6 on the country charts and even crossed over to the pop charts at number 16. It won a Best Country Song Grammy. The next song was a Hank Williams song. That's not Hank Williams Sr., but Hank Williams Jr. from 1982, A Country Boy Can Survive. And we talked in the interview about the redneck reclamation in the 1970s. And so this song came up a little bit after that redneck pride moment first started in the 70s. In 1982, he went up to number 2 on the country charts with A Country Boy Can Survive. But it's expressing that same sort of redneck pride or country pride. Those terms are often used interchangeably about the white working class and not always about Southerners.
Although both of those first two songs, it seemed to me, had echoes of rejection of sort of bourgeois morals, actually, like the Hank Williams song, We Don't Give a Damn.
No, totally. I talk about those songs a lot in my latest work. I talk about them in my book as well, under the heading of Anti-Bourgeois Country.
Oh, really?
And, yes. Yep. Hank Williams Jr.'s Country Boy Can Survive is absolutely a very strong anti-bourgeois country musical statement.
What about the Roger Miller's King of the Road? Tell us about that one.
1965, that was a number one song, a big crossover hit. It made it all the way to number 4 on the pop charts. And King of the Road by Roger Miller, who was also the songwriter, is relevant in a number of ways, but especially here's a big old classic country hit that is clearly about the hobo subculture and riding the rails. And there's also a less well-known history that I wanted to sneak in with that selection, because hobo subculture was a homosocial subculture. It was a male culture, and it was also a homosexual subculture. That was not well-known in 1965, and I think it's still not well-known, although by now there is a lot more scholarship on that. So whether or not Roger Miller had that in mind when he wrote and sang the song, it is a connection to the hobo homo subculture. Then the next song takes us way up to 2004. That was Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman, which is a huge mega hit for her and her breakout single, her first song on the charts. It was not only number one, but it won the Grammy for Best Country Vocal and a number of other awards that year. It crossed over and hit number 22 on the pop charts. And I have a whole chapter devoted to that song in my book. It's so chock full of not only anti-bourgeois sentiment, it's another one of those songs that brings us up from 1982 and Hank Williams's version of anti-bourgeois country. She name checks Hank Williams in that song by his nickname, Bocephus, which is what his dad had called him. She name checks Kid Rock and a number of other people too. And this is a huge anti-bourgeois statement that is also brilliantly a feminist statement. Whether or not, I don't know if Gretchen Wilson would call herself a feminist and use that label with all its bourgeois connections.
Big, strong women. She reveled in the women's culture and women's solidarity, it seems to me, in that song.
Yep, because in her chorus she says, let me hear a big hell yeah from the redneck girls like me, and then a sort of motley crew of female voices comes in with the hell yeah. At the same time, it's so smart in its strategy because she is not leaving white working class males behind. In fact, she is arraying a pantheon of hard rock and hard country men around her, so that in her statement about strong women, she makes it very clear that there's not a binary rejection of working class men. The rejection is of bourgeois values, bourgeois judgments of her and her people, male and female.
And finally, Casey Musgraves, which is really interesting. Tell us about that song.
So the Casey Musgraves song, Follow Your Arrow, was her breakout single from her breakout album in 2013. This single reached number 10 on the country charts and had a little bit of crossover action, number 60 on the pop charts. It was also the Country Music Association Song of the Year. It got so much press, so much play in the mainstream, liberal, sort of progressive press, because they used the song to tell one of the only stories that you can find in the mainstream progressive press about country music, which is, look at this, there's a liberal message in country. Whoa, it must be blowing people's minds. And my friend Julie Height, who's a fantastic Nashville journalist, has pointed out that story is really flawed. This was not a mind-blowing message in country music. It reached number 10 on the country charts. It's no big deal for her to talk about the things in the song that listeners heard there, about people rolling a joint or kiss lots of boys, she's singing from a female perspective, or kiss lots of girls if that's something you're into. It didn't blow people's minds so much.
That line, love who you love, that's repeated and repeated, that sort of, but you point out that has antecedents in country music. It wasn't, in fact, it wasn't even her original, she took the line from I guess.
That line echoes. Yeah. A song from Rascal Flatts in 2009, verbatim. And then we can go way back to 1992 and the Garth Brooks song, We Shall Be Free, which had an even clearer statement. When we're free to love anyone we choose, we shall be free. So, yeah, you see why it was not mind-blowing in country. It had, as you say, antecedents.
Dean Hubbs, thanks a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. This has been great.
It has been great. So long.